Yeah, if you, I'll leave this up here. If you would like to take another pebble or two after the service. Our scripture for this morning comes from 2 Kings chapter 6, verses 8 through 23. And this is a text I haven't encountered for a while, so it was fun for me to explore it, which means I'm going to go on a little long, but we won't talk about that. And we read, once when the king of Aram was at war with Israel, he took counsel with his officers. He said, at such and such a place shall be my camp. But the man of God sent word to the king of Israel, take care not to pass this place, because the Arameans are going down there. The king of Israel sent word to the place of which the man of God spoke. More than once or twice he warned such a place so that it was on the alert. The mind of the king of Aram was greatly perturbed because of this. He called his officers and said to them, now tell me, who among us sides with the king of Israel? Then one of his officers said, no one, my lord king. It is Elisha, the prophet in Israel, who tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedchamber. He said, go and find where he is. I will send and seize him, he was told. He is in Dothan. So he sent horses and chariots there, and a great army. They came by night and surrounded the city. When the attendant of the man of God rose early in the morning and went out, an army with horses and chariots was all around the city. His servant said, alas, master, what shall we do? He replied, do not be afraid, for there are more with us than there are with them. Then Elisha prayed, O Lord, please open his eyes, or the eyes of the servant. I'm sorry, open his eyes so that he may see. So the Lord opened the eyes of the servant and saw the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. When the Arameans came down against him, Elisha prayed to the Lord and said, strike these people, please, with blindness. So he struck them with blindness as Elisha had asked. Elisha said to them, this is not the way, and this is not the city. Follow me, and I will bring you to the man whom you seek. And he led them to Samaria. As soon as they entered Samaria, Elisha said, Lord, open the eyes of these men so that they may see. The Lord opened their eyes, and they saw that they were inside Samaria. When the king of Israel saw them, he said to Elisha, Father, shall I kill them? Shall I kill them? He answered, no. Did you capture with your sword and your bow those whom you want to kill? Set food and water before them so that they may eat and drink, and let them go to their masters. So he prayed for them, or he prepared for them a great feast. After they ate and drank, he sent them on their way, and they went to their master, and the Arameans no longer came raiding in the land of Israel. Now, earlier this week, as I was sort of talking through the scripture to Tricia, as I often do, she said, I need something, maybe a picture, maybe a map. So I got you a map, dear. So to help us establish a little context, let's start with a little geography lesson. Now our tale takes place, does this have a laser on it? Our tale takes place at a time when the nation of Israel was divided into two kingdoms, the kingdom of Israel to the north and the kingdom of Judah to the south. And Elisha was a prophet in the northern kingdom. And you can see that Samaria is part of the northern kingdom. So what you can also see is that the kingdom of Israel, the northern kingdom, shared a pretty extensive boundary with Aram up here in the corner. And Aram had been a thorn in Israel's side for some time. And while the Arameans were generally considered larger and more powerful than Israel's defenses, it seems that Israel, at least up to that time, had been able to keep its Aramean enemies at bay. You can take the map down, thank you. So you can imagine the king of Aram's fury when he plans attacks and then they're suddenly thwarted. And not just once, but multiple times, according to our scripture. It's almost as if the Israelites were catching wind of the king's plans ahead of time, right? Which is why it's no surprise that when an enraged king of Aram calls together his officers and he says, okay, who is it? You know there's some concern there. He says, which one of you has sided with the enemy? Where is the Israelite spy who has invaded our ranks? Who is the traitor who has brought treason among us? Now, just to be clear, no one in their right mind is going to step up and raise their hand, right? In response to this kind of interrogation. I mean, just because the king is losing his head doesn't mean that somebody else should, literally, right? So imagine the courage, or maybe it was the ignorance, of the king's officer who not only elects to answer the king's question, but reveals an even more preposterous reality. Because the officer goes to the king and says, listen, it's not me. In fact, it's not any of us. It's this prophet, Elisha, who is way over in Israel. And we're not exactly sure how, but somehow he's intercepting your plans. And did I mention he's way over in Israel? And he tells the king, everything you say, he hears. Even the things you say when you're in your most private places. Now, understandably, the king is infuriated, and I have to believe he's a little bit confused because there just weren't a plethora of electronic listening devices like there are in our day, right? There's no, hey, Alexa, or hey, Google, tell me the private thoughts of the king over there in Aram. Oh, and while you're at it, play Baby Shark on repeat until it drives him bonkers. Truly beside himself at this point, the king of Aram insists that his officers find this man who's foiling his military advances, and seize him and bring him before the military tribunal. And his officers inform him that the man he's looking for is in Dothan, which is about 12 miles north of Samaria. So the king sends a large regiment of horses and chariots and soldiers to surround the city where the prophet Elisha is staying. Now, I don't want us to miss the irony here, that this large military assembly is sent to capture a solitary prophet who doesn't seem to be militant in the least. But I guess that's our human nature, right? Our frustration and fear mingled together with embarrassment and over-exaggeration can cause us to react in situations in which we feel threatened. So much so that when morning arrives and Elisha's attendant goes out early in the morning, he finds the city surrounded by horses and chariots and soldiers. And I imagine he runs back into the house, not even bothering to close the door behind him, tears into Elisha's room and reveals what he's seen. And Elisha says, "What are you so worried about? Don't be afraid. There are more of us than there are of them." Now, I'm a firm believer that there are things in this world that we can't see. Call them spirits, call them ghosts, call them angels, whatever. But just because we can't see them, whether that's because our eyes can't detect them or our minds can't comprehend them, that doesn't mean they're not there. And while belief in a spiritual realm was likely more prevalent in the ancient Near East than it is in our world today, I can't help but imagine Elisha's attendant looking around a good bit and seeing only these forces of Aram breathing down their necks, and they're anything but friendly. So Elisha prays that his servant's eyes might be opened. And suddenly his servant sees that the mountains surrounding Samaria are crowded with troops and horses and chariots of fire that only moments ago were invisible to him. Now, it's difficult to say exactly what the author of this story intends by such a vision. And while there have been multitudes of attempts at artistic depiction, I'm not sure anyone fully captures it. I mean, is it an actual army kept hidden until this very moment? Is it an angel army ready to defend the Israelites to the death? Is it an illusion meant solely to appease the fears of Elisha's attendant? Whatever this vision is, it seems to do the trick, at least until the Aramean army begins to attack. Now, you would think that when the Arameans begin to attack, Elisha would employ this heavenly horde of beasts and battalions and decimate that earthly Aramean army. After all, what good is a supernatural fighting force if you aren't going to use them, right? Or maybe that's the same thing we say about our fighting force here in the States. But Elisha chooses another approach. And when the Aramean army comes to attack, Elisha prays for the opposite, that they would be struck blind. Blind to what? We're not really told, but definitely blind to Elisha, or to who Elisha is, because he tells them that they've gone the wrong way. And then he leads them to Samaria. And when that proverbial wool is pulled from their eyes, they discover they're deep in Israelite territory. And the king of Israel asks Elisha, not once, but twice, if he might destroy the Arameans. To which Elisha replies, "No, you didn't capture them. You didn't defeat them with the sword or the bow." Or maybe it was more like, "They're not a product of your violent nature. They are the product of God's intervention." In other words, what the king imagined was the logical outcome of war, i.e. destruction. But what the prophet of God imagined was a different outcome, life. So Elisha calls for this great feast, and the Aramean army is given nourishment and sustenance and allowed to return to their masters and their lands and their families. And as the story goes, the Arameans never raided the Israelites again. Well, at least not for a little while. As modern people of faith, we may be able to identify with the underdog of Israel's plight and the persecution by the Arameans. And as modern people of faith, we can understand the fear and frustration that might accompany seeing hordes of enemy invaders lined up at our borders. And as modern people of faith, we might even be able to comprehend the animosity and antagonism that those who sought the destruction were feeling. And in this way, we are no different than any king or general, ancient or modern, whose primary reaction to conflict is to defeat the opposing side with weaponry and bloodshed. So there are two lessons I think this little tale has to teach us if we're paying attention. The first lesson is that somehow we suffer from a loss of amazement, from a loss of imagination, and the belief that something beyond what our minds can conceive is even possible. After all, the army that Elisha showed his attendant wasn't a real army, or at least not in the way we think of armies, but an army of God. An army of God that did not act upon human intentions, did not see violence as its first line of defense. In fact, we don't even know if it was physically present to anyone but Elisha's servant. Could we imagine such an army in our modern day? Or is our sense of awe in this world a bygone aspect of our evolution? Has our search for scientific answers stolen from us the ability to consider an alternative other than what is tangible or concrete? Has our unbelief kept us from recognizing alternatives to the violence in our world? Have we lost the ability to consider that the antidote to weakness is not power, but compassion? Have we given up the capacity to comprehend, as children of God, that when we destroy the other, we destroy part of ourselves? Have we somehow lost sight of the fact that the solution to our arguments is listening to one another rather than shooting each other? Is it even possible to imagine an alternative? The second lesson I think we can glean from this text is the tangible side of God's power. As Elisha tells his servant to prepare the table of fellowship. Now, throughout the Bible, we're offered visions of table fellowship. In Psalm 23, the psalmist reflects, "You prepare a table for me in the presence of mine enemies." You see, not only is Psalm 23 about personal peace, it's also about interpersonal peace envisioned through table fellowship with enemies. In the story of Zacchaeus, we're all familiar with that, the tax collector, the crowd is standing around confounded and confused when Jesus went to share a meal with this despised individual. Why? because it was a sign of acceptance, a sign of brotherhood, a sign that this man, who many considered an enemy of the people, could be imagined as one of them. And of course, there's Paul's assertion in 1 Corinthians that the central tenet of the earliest gatherings of believers was to gather together around a meal that in awe and imagination was the equivalent of sharing Jesus' body and blood with one another. Have we lost the ability to imagine that kind of fellowship? Elisha imagined that the fellowship meal was about more than just food. It was about relationships. It was about compassion. It was about acceptance. And it's about peace. When the church is more concerned with saving souls than feeding them, I think we've failed to imagine who Jesus called us to be. When the church is more concerned about who's at the table than who isn't, I think we've failed to imagine who Jesus called us to be. And when the church is more concerned with heavenly armies than it is with peace on earth, I think we've failed to imagine who Jesus called us to be. But what if we could regain the ability to imagine peace in the midst of conflict, to imagine that brotherhood and sisterhood can come from gathering at a table with one another, and to imagine that seeking peace together, we discover God's forces of life, not death, are gathered all around us.